Are you fucking real, man? Come on.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Swords, Sorcery, and Socialism, a podcast about the themes and politics hiding in our genre fiction, and sometimes not hiding, as is the case today. as always, I am Darius, and with me is my co-host, Ketho. How's it going, Ketho?
It's going good.
As I said, you know, our little intro tag, we talk about the themes in politics that hide inside of our stories. Sometimes they don't hide. Such is the case is when you have an author of the stylings and quality of one Philip K. Dick and his sort of most famous and most well-known story, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Better known by some people as the book that was adapted into the movie Blade Runner.
Which is just absurd to me. Like, I get that they just didn't want to use a title like this. But also, Blade Runner is the title of a completely different book that actually exists.
Yeah, but it sounds cool.
It sounds cool. But it's like, wait, is this an adaptation? What? I don't know what Ridley Scott was thinking. To be fair, it's Ridley Scott. No one knows what he's thinking.
No one knows what he's thinking.
Ever.
Well, all I can say is that he was thinking good things because the movie kicks ass. However,
yes,
we're not here to talk.
Yeah, top two Ridley Scott movies. Top three.
We're unfortunately not here to talk about Ridley Scott this time. If you want us to talk about Ridley Scott, sign up for the Patreon. We'll talk about Ridley Scott in a bonus episode.
Maybe.
However, today we're talking about the actual book. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? That was published in 1968. First off, why are we talking about, why'd we pick this one right now? Like, what, I think you were the one that suggested this one. Why did you suggest this one to read right now?
Well, been a couple weeks since all that announcement about Elon Musk's Neuralink and all this other nonsense, and then the fiasco with the apes that they put the Neuralinks into all dying, for the most part.
Yeah.
In some horrific refutation of the annoyed engineering student who doesn't want to take the ethics class that he has to take.
Yeah, I remember seeing a tweet going around that was like, or it was like a tweet that, like, the headline of an article that was like, why STEM majors should take an ethics class.
Yeah, unfortunately, an ethics class doesn't fix someone as dumb as Elon Musk.
No. Also, but that is also the, I think, the second title of this book is Why STEM People Should Take Ethics.
of honestly, most Philip K. Dick novels. You could, like, the man, Total Recall.
The man had a lane, okay?
It's not Total Recall. Sorry, it's I Can Remember It For You Wholesale.
Better known as Total Recall.
Better known as Total Recall. I think that's the thing about PKD.
Is all of his titles are absurd.
All of his. I have right in front of me what I think might be his most insane title, which is The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. It's a book about drugs, because Philip K. Dick did a lot of drugs.
All of his books are about drugs. Anyway, we had this news story come out about Neuralink,
yeah,
and the dead monkeys, and that inspired you to say, maybe we should cover this right now.
Yeah, I was like, you know what? Because I had read the thing, and then I popped out and made a statement that the most heartbreaking scene in this novel is when, spoilers, the goat dies.
Oh yeah, obviously. Well, the two most heartbreaking scenes are the goat and finding out the goat's dead, and the androids killing the spider.
Oh yeah, yeah. The most upsetting things that happened in this entire book, and it's like Voight Kampff tests are being done on us.
It's almost like he did that on purpose.
On purpose.
But I mean, yeah, he's literally Voight Kampffing you, like, in the novel by, like, forcing you to have an emotional reaction to the animals being killed in front of you in the story. Like, I would struggle to necessarily say that he did it entirely intentionally, but I wouldn't be surprised if he did.
I think he kind of intentionally, especially with the spider, he intentionally draws out the cruelty of the act, and then, you know, Isidore's reactions to it also make you feel worse.
Isidore, the single saddest character in this story.
The saddest character in this entire story. The only one that you probably feel a distinct amount of empathy for.
The only one who objectively doesn't do anything bad.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, technically, Deckard's wife also does not do anything.
That's true, but she's barely in the book.
But she's barely in the book. Of characters,
she just kind
of
sits around at home and dials in depression. It's
like, again,
she's a depressed housewife because she chooses to be depressed.
Well, I think she. Well, she would be depressed. She would be depressed anyway.
Yes, the only, she absolutely.
The only reason she's not depressed is because she has a Neuralink.
Yes, she has a Neuralink, and the tweet essentially I had posted on was a tweet that said something along the lines of this company was like, "Yay, we made the time twister from famous novel. Do not make the time twister," because the thing that you've already mentioned and the thing that we'll probably bring up a lot is that this is Philip K. Dick, which in a field of fiction which isn't very subtle, he is one of the least subtle.
Yeah, his whole MO is, here's a shitty thing that could be coming down the pipe. What if we don't do the shitty thing that I can tell you is coming? And then every single company from Tesla to whatever the hell you call all of Peter Thiel's companies are just like, we've done the thing.
The Rosin Corporation is essentially the blueprint for things that would become stuff like Weyland-Yutani, Umbrella Corp. Like, they
every
are
every evil corporation you can think of in like your video games all come from the Rosins, like all of them.
I'm sure there were other, you know, massive evil conglomerate corporations and stuff previous.
But this is the big one that like people are referencing.
Because they're not even depicted in the novel as the villains necessarily, but they are always in the background, and you're always kind of aware that this is their fault.
Yeah, I mean, Deckard pretty clearly thinks it's their fault.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he does. But, it's not, he's not fighting against the Rosin Corporation. He can't really fight against the Rosin Corporation. He just does his job, which is to kill androids that have escaped. In the process, he's, you know, realizing just how much of this is the Rosin Corporation's fault, including the death of his goat.
Yes.
All being direct causal, having direct causal links to the Rosin Corporation.
See, my audiobook pronounced it Rosin the whole time.
Rosin? Listen, I've only ever read it. I tried to find an audiobook of it, but for some reason, the only audiobook I could find of it available at any library was a dramatized novelization of the Blade Runner film.
Interesting. I just stole it. So
that or they literally were marketing this book as a book called Blade Runner.
Yeah. So even the audiobook set is Blade Runner. Formerly published under the name Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
That's a better name for this book than Blade Runner. Runner's never like
even the audiobook calls it Blade Runner and then says that it comes from the novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. That's not what we're here to complain about normally. Those are just my personal complaints. We're here to talk about this complex sort of philosophical question that Philip K. Dick poses to us, which is, what if robot was person? Now what?
Oh, now what?
Yeah, so Ketho, now what?
Yeah.
You're the smart one. A robot's kind of a person, maybe.
So
now what?
The thing that I find super interesting about this book, that I think a lot of people would miss if they've only ever watched the film, is the film very clearly just tries to make you empathize with the androids. Like, that's the whole point of the film. By the end, that's the whole point of the speech at the end that everyone remembers.
We'll take the time out. Yes, the speech kicks ass. Yes, we know it was improvised on the basically on the spot by Rucker Hauer. Yes, it's
cool. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, the robot, he wasn't supposed to give a speech, and Rucker Hauer was like, that doesn't make sense. It feels like he would have something to say. And so then he just like wrote his own little speech. So again, that's really cool. That also doesn't happen in this book.
Yeah. So like the main point of that film is to empathize with the androids. In this one, I don't know how much you really empathize with the androids, first of all. But the point isn't necessarily, oh, are androids people, so much as what makes people any different.
I think before you continue, I do think that that is sort of the key difference in what the message is between the book and then the movie. The movie is very much robots can be people too, and you should feel and you should feel bad about it. Where the book, if you ask, you know, Philip K. Dick's sort of, you know, imaginary narrator for this book, they would tell you that androids aren't people. Like, it's pretty clear throughout the book that the androids aren't people, and they don't try that hard. They don't try that hard to make you think that they are. They go out of their way to remind you that they're not. And like you said, the point of the book is to use the androids as a lens through which to view what makes people people.
Yeah.
Not and are the androids people.
Because the whole device of the androids isn't as a, oh, these robots are living and they're like actually alive. The whole point of them is to be this supposedly empathy-less thing to judge, to kind of contrast the characters in the book with. And we'll get, you know, more deeply into individual characters over time. The first one that springs to my mind is someone like Phil Resch, who is kind of sadistic and kind of a psychopath when you sit down and actually look at it.
Well, it's proposed near the beginning when Deckard goes to the Rosencorp, when he's like getting ready to give the test to Rachel. They propose to him, they're like, well, what if you just had a person who didn't have empathy? Then you could fuck it up and accidentally label a person an android. Of course, that gets dismissed by Deckard because he tests Rachel and actually figures out that she is an android. But then later in the book, you get Resch, who is basically a person who could almost fail the Voight-Kampff test. He doesn't, but he almost could.
It's just super bizarre that you end up in the situation where he didn't fail the test, but you're aware that this person shows very little empathy in general. The only thing that the Voight-Kampff test tests for.
Yeah, is empathy. Which again, it will get on, we can talk about later, is such an important thing that it's basically also the entire religion is feeling empathy.
Yeah, through the little empathy boxes.
Through an empathy box with the prophet Mercer. But we won't talk about him yet. But I think that's obviously pretty clearly the key of the book here is like this debate between, you know, using the robots as a lens through which to view human empathy and like the importance of it and how you handle someone who doesn't have it. And it also does go out of its way to remind you that the androids absolutely do not.
Oh yeah, they do not.
Absolutely like even, do not.
Even like the textbook example of this situation is the scene with the spider. And here's the thing. I fucking hate spiders. I hate them. Sorry to all of our listeners who are like, oh, spiders are our friends. I don't care.
Yes,
I don't want them within 500 feet of me. I don't want to see one. I don't want to think that
friends.
They exist.
I'm going to replace. I know they are our friends. I'm going to replace you with the spider co-host.
Cool. Go ahead. I'm sure he'd be great. I just don't ever want to meet him. PKD goes out of his way to make sure that you feel extremely empathetic towards the spider as it is being tortured to death.
He sure does.
And in this world, and this is another major difference between the book and the film, like most living animals are dead because this novel, unlike the film, is a post-apocalyptic novel. This is a post-nuclear war novel. And this is apparent throughout the whole book because there's just significantly less people than you would expect in a big city. There is so much empty space.
I think that is actually, and I hate to continually do the like book versus the movie comparison, but I think it's important here because some of the themes that we're focusing on are the ones that the movie leaves out completely. And emptiness, I think, is one of the big themes that the movie doesn't touch on at all. Like the first few chapters of this book, before you even get to empathy, are entirely about emptiness. It's the emptiness that his wife feels. It's the emptiness that he feels and the emptiness that Isidore feels, right? Like, and it, because a lot of the opening chapters are about the fact that literally everyone is either dead or emigrated. All the animals are dead. It's the whole point of them having animals is because you're proving your empathy by keeping a living thing alive. And like, so this emptiness of the city that they live in is an important point, as opposed to the movie where he's just like running around, you know, I know it's San Francisco, but it might as well be Neo Tokyo or whatever you want to call it, because there's people everywhere. You can crash into a goddamn noodle shop.
But yeah, it's distinctly empty, like almost painfully empty. And
clearly is painful for some of the characters.
Yeah. The empathy box is like a weird attempt at getting the people who are left to like reconnect with each other, because there's no way to have, at least in this version of events, there's apparently not many ways to have a sense of community in a community that is either emigrating or dying into non-existence. So especially when you're someone like Isidore, who is plainly the most empathetic character in the book, not just because he is the most empathetic himself, but also because like he's probably the most deserving of said empathy is because he's essentially a mutant. Like he's effectively a, like he's been irradiated into unintelligence essentially.
Yes.
Lower cognitive function because of radiation. That does bring me to the one little thing about the lead codpiece that is very funny.
I wish the movie had made Harrison Ford wear a giant lead codpiece.
It's so funny. It's I think that's something that PK Dick does a lot. He just, the absurdity is the humor, because he, like, you can tell that he's doing that sort of thing on purpose, and whatever humor comes out of his stories is entirely due to the absurdity of the situation. And he designs it that way, and this you know, this leads into, with those themes of emptiness through like the empathy box, or through I think more like plainly through the mood organ being used to kind of fill empty emotions.
Yeah, to fill that emptiness.
Like you said, the first couple chapters, just that's everything in those chapters. You have the mood organ that fills the space in those chapters. You have the empathy box that does. You have the
Buster
Friendly show.
You have the Buster Friendly show. You have Isidore turning the TV off and then back on again, and then meeting the first android, even though he doesn't know it's an android.
Yeah.
Where like it's still him attempting to fill the emptiness.
Mm-hmm. Like he doesn't even have a gift to give her. He just grabs a block of margarine.
Yeah, but he does because he's like, oh, what did people used to do back when you had neighbors? You would give them a gift. So what can I give? This margarine, I guess. The other thing is Isidore actually, I think sort of references his emptiness in a weird way when he's talking to, I forget the name of that android. I forget which one that one is. The first girl, the girl that's there. When he talks about, I forget, what's his word for junk? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Where he has a whole little speech he gives her about the fact that if you leave the apartments empty on their own, they begin to fill with junk because the junk self-replicates. And I think it's, I think going off this conversation about emptiness, I think in his obviously somewhat differently functioning brain, it's a way for him to like make the emptiness of the empty apartment building not feel so empty. You know what I mean? It's like almost a physical representation of filling the space. Is he just imagines that every apartment with junk in it, the junk replicates. You know what I mean? Like it's
Kipple, by the way.
Kipple, right. The Kipple. He's talking about the Kipple because it's the only way he can cope with the fact that everything around him is completely empty. And so he's like fighting the entropy of emptiness by like telling himself that the apartments fill with Kipple on their own.
There's a line in here that I underlined. It's, I don't usually write up my books, but every now and then I underline lines that I particularly like. And I underlined this the first time I read it. Mm-hmm. And I think it actually says a lot about this situation right now. He lived alone in this deteriorating blind building of 1,000 uninhabited apartments, which, like all its counterparts, fell day by day into greater entropic ruin. That's the entire setting of this book, is decaying buildings and the few people that are left living sometimes huge gulfs of space between one another, and less and less concentrated, even less concentrated than that, the further out from city center you get, to the point where Isidore is essentially living in the suburbs almost. And he's living in an apartment building, and he's the only one in the entire apartment building of hundreds of apartments by himself. And the movie tries to kind of do that with the apartments that the final confrontation kind of happens in. But in the movie, it's just that. It's just that location that's like that.
Yeah.
It's like, in this, it's the whole of Earth, pretty much, that's like that.
Yeah, they're living in one of the more populated places in San Francisco.
And still, even even the apartment that Rick and his wife live in, when she turns off the radio, when she turns off the TV, there's no one close by enough for her to be able to hear them. It's just silence. And there's other people that live in that apartment building. They have a neighbor.
They've got a couple. They've got a few neighbors.
They have a few neighbors, but it's still... It's still, instead of like one in 100, it's now like, oh, maybe there's 50 apartments and there's 10 people here.
It's still mostly empty.
Still mostly empty. Again, either from people dying from the radiation or offloading to Mars.
Yeah, which again was one of the other sort of major themes that the movie had to sort of drop for brevity, is the fact that, like, when you're getting rid of the emptiness, you're getting rid of the fact that, like, mostly that everyone is being encouraged to get the fuck off planet. Mm-hmm. And Deckard only hasn't gotten off planet because he can't. Because his job won't let him.
Yeah, his job is to stay home and kill androids that come back to Earth from outer space. Because that's the thing, is like, androids are legal on colonies. They're legal off-world. Mm. They're not technically legal on Earth.
Yeah, they also can't be unaccompanied.
Yeah. So it's like they're not allowed to be solo. They're not allowed to be like functional on their own as individual actors. They're machines for the most part, is what they're designed to do. To go to these colony worlds and help build things in places that people can't go.
They're also meant to be, well, I mean, the book isn't even the subtle about it. They're built to be slaves for the humans that go off world. Because the whole advertisements you get are, you go off world, you get an android designed to your specifications. Mm-hmm. By going off world, it's the reward of going off world.
And every now and again, they fucking bust rank and not bust rank. They fucking like break line and escape.
So like, I wanted to bring this up at some point. I might as well do it now. The book, definitely. It's not Philip K. Dick. He's doing it through the advertisement for the androids. Again, his usual unsubtlety. One of the ads for the androids literally says, like the halcyon days of the plantation.
Yeah, it does. It's
it literally says, like the halcyon days before the American Civil War. You can have a servant that does everything for you. So like, it is spectacularly, it's got the subtlety of a giant like rubber Acme mallet, the idea that these things are built to be slaves for you.
Yeah, which is like, despite this book's attempt, and in a lot of spaces success at making you not necessarily feel the most empathy for the androids, like that's always kind of looming behind you. It's like they're escaping, and this is again something the movie does touch on, but you know, they're escaping from slavery for the most part.
Yes.
They're running away from being forced to do things, and that, you know,
and they've been designed with enough free will and personality to not want to be slaves.
Yeah. So it's like, are they really not? Are they that different from people? Like they obviously understand the idea of not wanting to be a slave.
Yeah. Which again, though, I think what Philip K. Dick is really driving at here, though, is yes, there's the sort of the face question of do these androids then have, you know, personalities and, you know, freedoms and like autonomy and that sort of thing. But I think behind that, the layer is, again, and I think, which is probably more what PKD was driving at, is what is the morality behind designing a robot that would have these feelings?
Yeah.
Because like whether the robot had the technicalities of the autonomy of the soul of the android is one thing. But the bigger thing is, what is the morality of the Rosen Corporation setting out to design a robot that can despise the slavery you're designing it for? You are designing this thing to be a slave and then also programming it to hate that it is.
To be aware of that.
To be aware of the fact that it's a slave, which I think is the much more sort of like existential question here.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's depicted a little bit as, you know, like that being obviously like most novels, like Justin, when they present a giant grand philosophical question, they never necessarily answer it. That one gets answered pretty aggressively, where it's like, yes, this is really fucked up. Because in that instance, bringing up the question itself answers the question. You know what I mean?
You bring up, this fucked up to do?
Yeah, when you bring up the question, is it kind of fucked up to maybe create a living, not necessarily even a living being, but a being that is aware of the fact that it is not free? And then even though you know you're going to use it for menial slave labor?
I mean, the most recent, I think, I mean, this may show my sort of out of touch with media, but I remember one of the more recent sort of flippant uses of this question, you know, forgive me for making this reference, was the GIF that is shown over and over again from Rick and Morty.
Is it the butter robot?
The butter robot, where he's like, what is my purpose? You butter the toast. That's it? That's it.
You pass butter.
He's just, you pass butter. And the robot goes, oh, God. And it's like the morality of why would you design the robot to be able to question its own existence? Like the cruelty there isn't in I made a robot that does a job. It's I also made the robot aware of the fact that it must do this job and it has no other alternative, but there could be other alternatives, but I didn't give them to him.
That's
like I programmed.
Now you're getting into like God shit.
I programmed existential dread into my AI. Like,
oh boy, this,
why
that, cause that question could be used by, that could be used for humanity in and of itself.
I mean, you could literally turn that into a theological question.
Yes.
If you're a theist and you know, if you believe in like divine creation, then that's one of the questions that has to be answered within your religious faith is why would your creator create you in such a way that you can feel this existential dread? Now, all the different religions will give you different answers to that question as to why. And it, you know, it's all varying things, but you're right. You can definitely place it there. Cause like you said, you're becoming a god at this point when you're doing it with robots.
Yeah. It's hubris, really. In the case of this book, at least, I think it's hubris when it comes to billionaires now, where they're just, you know, I'll do it because I can, and yeah, you're like, well, you just killed like 25 monkeys, Elon, so maybe shut the fuck up.
This question, there's also an answer to it, as put eloquently in verse form by one of our preeminent poets, Zach De La Rocha. In one of his songs, he says, call her a skin job and my honey do a backflip for you. You play in God, your eye sockets, she gonna rip into. So if you feel like you need to play God, you should expect that your creations are going to fucking kill you.
Yeah, you should. And I mean, they do. And like, they know that. That's the thing that's so funny to me is that they're capable of creating these creatures that they're designing for slave labor. They are designing them to know
that they are slaves.
They're slaves. And they kind of like expect them to fucking break out and escape because they also have people whose job it is to kill them.
Well, the Rosen Corporation doesn't pay those people, though.
No, but at the same
Rosen Corporation seems pretty intent on Deckard not killing androids.
It's like they also, but it's, and additionally, like they don't know how to program empathy. They don't know, or they don't do it on purpose. I don't know how to program a robot with empathy.
I think with Rachel, when he does the Voight comp test on her, it's shown that she's been taught the proper way to react. She just does it too slowly.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't do it all of the time, but in certain situations, her body reacts appropriately, just too slowly, which to me indicates that they were trying to teach her the proper thing to do, which I think means if they could give the androids empathy, they would.
Yeah.
Because they would want them to pass all tests possible.
It's just, why do all this if you know that they're not going to be able to feel empathy? So it's like you're designing this thing that has all the functions of a human, is going to be used as slave labor, and has no empathy. You're designing psychopaths.
Yes, which the book clearly shows that they are.
They are. It's like you're designing psychopaths, but then instead of pointing that gun at the Rosen Corporation, what you do is you shoot the android that they built.
Because the Rosen Corporation is too big for Deckard to shoot.
Yeah.
Like,
in fact, it's so big that even though he's just doing his fucking job, they screw him over.
They kill his fucking goat, man.
They kill his fucking goat.
They piss on his fucking rug.
And trick him into, well, I mean, we can't place all that blame on Rachel, but I say trick him in quotation marks into having sex with her.
Tempt him.
I love how the book is just like, this model robot, the Rachel model robot, just designed to make men want to fuck them. Yeah. And you're like,
we specifically designed this robot to make dudes act unwise.
Yeah, that's why
we specifically designed to make you act
because
unwise.
Because the two of the three female androids you meet in this book are the same model.
The first one that Isidore meets and Rachel are the same model.
And that becomes a little bit complicated when Rick goes to...
What the fuck is that one's name?
When he goes to kill the last three. Because Rachel warned him that one of them is her model after they fucked. And
now he's like, wait, that's the same one that I had sex with. Except it's not.
When he meets her, and even Isidore, it's then implied that, like, part of the reason Isidore's smitten with her isn't just because she's the first, like, person he's had contact with in a long time. It's also because it's, like, that model.
She also does answer the door the first time shirtless.
Well, yeah, but her specifically doesn't seem to really understand what that...
Yeah, no, she doesn't really get what that means.
She doesn't really get it.
Because she's a robot. Yeah, also, I think that's the one person that wouldn't be super off-putting to is probably Isidore, because he's kind of weird anyway.
Yeah.
I think like any other person would be significantly put off by the fact that she just answered the door shirtless.
I mean, maybe she's described as being very attractive.
But I'm saying if you were just a person and you knocked on someone's door and someone opened it up and it's just like shirtless, she'd be like, oh.
You'd be like, oh, I'd sorry. Be like, okay, I'm sorry.
You'd be like, oh, I'm sorry.
Away, you walk away and you think, I'm like, I feel
and
like
is Isidore's just, like oh.
Some porno out there.
Yeah. Isidore's just like, oh, okay, sure, why not?
Sure, that's normal.
So again, I think he's the only one that wouldn't immediately be suspicious of the fact that she's shirtless.
Yeah.
But you're right. So like, again, we're not going to come to an answer either, really, about why the Rosen Corporation is making empathetic, sexually attractive psychopaths. Like, is it just the fact that they can make more money with them?
Probably.
Is that it? Is that really it? Is it just capitalism?
I'm pretty sure Philip K. Dick was not a big capitalist, if you get my sense. I don't know what
Philip K. Dick's personal politics were, and I'm not going to look it up right now.
I just don't. I can't imagine someone who wrote this book being a big fan of capitalism.
It's not the right kind of sci-fi for that.
No, I'm.
It's not Heinlein.
Yeah, this isn't like depiction of a future world that has capitalism in it and it's a good thing. This is a future world depicted that has a massive multinational conglomerate that creates psychopaths for slave labor. I feel like that alone is just like
it's all you need to know.
It's anti-capitalist in aesthetic and essence. There's not much else that can be drawn from that. Again, I don't know what Phil's political persuasions were, but any piece of media that had anything to do with the inception of the cyberpunk genre is entirely not pro-capitalist.
I'm pretty sure he would have been in favor of drug legalization.
Oh, without, I mean, he was in the 60s. Most of it was legal at the time anyways, but yeah.
We used to be a proper country.
I used to be a proper nation. I could do as many, PKD could put as many LSD tabs under his tongue as he wanted.
Again, we used to be a nation, a proper nation.
Cocaine was legal, guys. Speaking of drugs,
do you want to go back and dial in a little bit on something that we referenced at the start
a good one.
On the fucking, was that the, shit, what's the fucking name of it again? The emotion organ.
Hold on, I'll pull up the specific actual name, the Penfield mood organ.
The fucking gender box. No, sorry, mood organ.
The Penfield mood organ, artificial brain stimulation. Essentially, they just punch in numbers and it makes them feel things.
Every emotion you could imagine, more or less, has a number attached with it. And whichever one you want, you walk over to the little box and you go bloop, bloop, bloop. And then zap, your brain feels the way that you told it to feel. You can also program it to make you feel certain ways at certain times. And I think that implies that generally it tries to like alter your mood based on the situation you will be in. Oh, excuse me. I yawned. I need my mood organ to make me feel zesty.
Yeah. I need mood organ 242, injects
talkative creativity for podcasting.
It's essentially caffeine.
Yeah, typically I just do caffeine for that, but it's a bit late. We're recording a bit late for this one, and it's too late for me to be doing more caffeine because I do want to go to bed at some point.
This thing seriously has everything, and he almost goes out of his way to list ridiculous shit to make you realize that this can do anything. Like you're the very first thing, it's like it immediately wakes him up. Like he doesn't go through grogginess or anything. He just snaps awake and is awake. And
it does also tell you that he is surprised to be awake.
Yes.
Which he is every day. Which, you know what? There was a time in my life where every time I woke up, I was like, damn, I'm surprised I woke up today.
Some of these are absurd. Like 594, pleased acknowledgement of husband's superior wisdom in all matters. that's just a petty joke from a guy who I'm sure has had lady problems in the past.
The patriarchy setting.
The patriarchy setting. I think it's funny, and he does it in a very self-aware way, but it's just
like it's not said in a way where he's like, this is an emotion the wife should be feeling. Because this comes at the end of, again, if you're only familiar with the movie, you also don't even know that Deckard Cain had a wife. Did they call him Deckard Cain?
Yeah, Rick Deckard.
Deckard Cain is an entirely different character from an entirely different series. It would like for you to stay a while and listen. Rick Deckard.
I'm gonna pretend I know what you're talking about.
You don't. It's fine. Rick Deckard has a wife, number one, whose name is Iran. Sorry, Iran or Erin or something. It looks like it's Iran. So
I think Iran. Like
his wife, the nation of Iran. Literally, the first scene is him waking up. Her not getting up as quickly because she didn't use the brain stimulator as much. And so she's crabby. And he's like, you should use the brain stimulator. And she's like, fuck yourself. And he's
get your cop hands away from me. What a way to introduce the fact that he's a cop.
She literally says, get your cop hands off me. He's like, I'm not a cop. She goes, you're worse than a cop. You're hired by the cops. So she literally says, you're worse than a cop. You're a rent-a-cop.
It's hilarious because the beginning of this book, now that I'm thinking about it, There's a couple cliches that they told us never to ever do ever.
Exposition.
Well, the cliche is waking up.
Oh, is it?
At the beginning.
Starting your story by waking up. Starting your
story by getting out of bed.
Is that a cliche? I can't remember.
Oh, yeah. It is probably the most popular.
I don't know how many other stories I've read where people start the story by waking up.
Where it's legit. But fundamentally, it's just funny because it's that. And then immediately, there's a little bit of clunky exposition through dialogue.
Where she's like, "You're a fucking cop, you dirty piece of shit." And he's like, "I'm not a cop. I'm hired by the cops." And she's like, "That's even worse."
It's like, "You're a murderer hired by the cops." And he's like, "I've never killed a human being in my life." And it's just those poor Andys.
And you know what? So being technically correct is the best kind of correct. He has never killed a human being in his life. Just those poor Andys.
Better than any other cop in existence.
Better than any actual real cop, yes.
That being said, he does kill the escaped slaves. Silence. I wanted that silence to be there. Make sure that silence makes it to the edit. Just nice. Extend it maybe. Another 10 seconds?
No. Just loop it. Just loop the silence. That presupposes I know how to use the loop function on Audacity. So again, the exposition is a little clunky, but let's get to the meat here. Let's talk about the brain drugs. So the brain drugs, he goes over and he's like, get up, you know, put some of the happy chemicals in your brain and we can behave like we're supposed to. And then he looks at her machine and she's programmed in being depressed for 3 hours. And he's like, "I didn't even know you could do that.
Wow,
I didn't
know that." Just like me for real.
Didn't know that was a setting. And she's like, "I had to figure it out. It's not listed." And that's when we also get our first reference of like the emptiness. She was sitting in this empty apartment building and began to feel the vast emptiness and pointlessness of existence settling in on her. And
well, she felt it, but because she had a different mood punched in, she understood it intellectually but did not feel it emotionally.
Yeah, she intellectually understood the emptiness of the world but didn't emotionally respond to it. And she was like, "I want to be able to emotionally respond to the sadness."
So she essentially punches in to be emotionally crippled for about 3 hours a day and then automatically bring her back out of it.
Deckard, I think, does make a pretty salient point here. I think that some of us do need to keep in mind, I think is true, that sort of mood is one that can sort of get you stuck in it. That if you're pretty accustomed to slipping into that sort of depression, whether you want to or not, it can be hard to come out of it, even when she has the brain juice box to do it intentionally.
Yeah, despair like that about total reality is self-perpetuating.
Which I think is an accurate statement.
Even with an automatic cutoff, it's dangerous to undergo a depression of any kind. Forget what you've scheduled, and I'll forget what I've scheduled.
I can tell you from experience, undergoing that sort of depression can be dangerous.
We'll dial a 104 together. Does it explain what a 104 is? I don't think it does.
I think it's just supposed to be happy, probably. Just some sort of general contentedness, I would imagine.
Yeah, so...
And then she's basically like, "Fuck yourself. I don't want to be happy. I want to be sad." And he's like, "Well, yeah, that's because you haven't used the brain juice." And she's like, "Yeah, I'm upset because I don't want to use the brain juice. So telling me that I need to push a button that will make me want the brain juice is the last thing I want to fucking do."
Yeah. And then it immediately gets into even more convoluted territory where she doesn't want to turn on the TV and... he says, "Dial 888, the desire to watch TV, no matter what's on it. I don't feel like dialing anything at all now. So then dial 3. I can't dial a setting that stimulates my cerebral cortex into wanting to dial." It's like, you can't, if I don't want to dial the button at all, why am I going to punch in something that's going to make me want to dial?
Like it's this circular logic where it's like, well, if you don't want to dial, you push the button that makes you want to dial.
Yeah, in this instance, I gotta say, like, Rick is on the losing end of this conversation.
Yeah, she's right.
But then at the very end, he's like, "I'm gonna punch in this thing that makes her acknowledge that my wisdom in all matters."
Well, it's because she gives up.
Yeah,
that's why she won the conversation. If there can be a winner, Like, I think from the reader's perspective, at least my perspective, she's right.
Yeah.
Like, she is right in so far as that, like, her assessment of the situation, I think, is accurate. And I think her point of view is one that I empathize with. But in the end, she just goes, fuck it, who gives a shit? Whatever. You want me to be fucking horny? I'll be fucking horny. Type in the fucking horny button. I don't give a shit. You're the fuck you want. And he's like, nah, I'll just make you be contented that I was right.
It's that entire first section. This is more like a little just impression. It's an almost funny, bizarrely futuristic, just lover spat. Like, this is no different. In essence, this is no different than any, like, upset, kind of not jiving couple, you know, getting into a spat in the morning because someone was groggy when they woke up. It's the same thing as, like, it's just over some bizarre futuristic technology.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It is like your standard, like, married couple arguing. It's just that what they're arguing about is this, like, existentially questioning sci-fi thing.
But that's just a totally accepted, hard-coded part of their world.
Yeah, where to us, we're like, you're arguing about a machine that will force you to, like, want to feel good about wanting to feel good?
And they're talking about it as though these philosophical questions have already been kind of decided. And yeah, they don't care. It's just a thing.
Well, I think that Deckard is very much on the, like, yeah, I mean, this is good for us because then you can feel the way you want or should to feel. You know what I mean? I don't think I use those words right. However, Iran is like, I don't think she's totally on board anymore with the idea that the thing is making you feel ways at the time. Like, I think she's given up on that because she has become too acquainted with the emptiness that we've been discussing this whole time.
Yeah.
And that she has just sort of does it via giving up.
Yeah, it's honestly, like, this entire book depressing. That first chapter, every chapter of this book is depressing, and I don't think you can talk about a more depressing topic in this entire book than the animals that are presented here, just period, from front to back.
And
I think we've already kind of mentioned that taking care of animals is seen as, like, an empathetic thing, but we really haven't brought up what the electric sheep part of Duandoy's dream of electric sheep comes from.
Yeah. Let's talk about why the fuck this talks about the name of this book has electric sheep in it.
So as we already mentioned, empathy, mercerism, it's a thing that people should be taking care of animals because there are very few animals left anywhere. there are very few animals left anywhere. So those that do exist should be taken care of. And those that can't take care of one because they can't afford an animal, they kind of show it through owning, similar to the electric people.
And ersatz animal.
Yeah, it's a electric creature of some kind that is almost entirely indistinguishable from the real thing, except for the fact that, you know, it doesn't, like, need to eat,
but it's designed in a way that you have to feed it.
Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of little things about it that make it, like, and it's almost like a cynical thing. Mercerism asks that you take care of an animal, but not everyone can. So in order to make sure that you look like you're not a shitty person, you'll go out and you'll get an electric animal, but then you'll protect the fact that it's an electric animal from everyone.
Because if everyone knows you have an electric animal, they'll look down on you for not having a real animal.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, these electric animals, these simulacra of animals are so well done that, like, and the cover has to be so complete that even to have them repaired, the company that repairs them puts on the entire facade of being vets, of being actual animal veterinarians.
Yes.
To the point where they dress up like vets, they drive a truck that says veterinary services on it, and they show up and they take care of your animal as if it was real, because they need to maintain the illusion that you have a real animal.
And speaking of,
that's who Isidore works for.
But he also drives
the truck.
It depressing encounter with a real animal. Number one, the cat that they pick up.
I was going to say the first depressing thing is when Deckard explains how his real sheep died because he missed one little tiny piece of metal on the baling wire of the food for his real sheep that then scratched the sheep and gave it tetanus and it died.
The animals die in the most like fucking sad ways.
Like pretty much every real animal you're introduced to dies except for like the neighbor's horse. The horse doesn't die, does it?
Is it real?
I mean, it's pregnant, supposedly.
Supposedly.
You never know for sure.
Never know for sure is the thing about... The animals
we have confirmed real in this story all die.
All die.
Two of them are murdered.
Yeah, two of them are just straight up killed in the... Like we already mentioned, the spider and Rick's goat when he buys it are just straight up killed. In fact, the goat, you never actually see alive. Physically, you only ever hear about it. He sees it in a catalog. He buys it in a catalog. Iran gets it, tells him that he gets it. He arrives home after killing the last androids and finds out that Rachel threw it off the roof. So he never actually gets to see it alive, despite spending the entire of the first three android bounties on it.
Yeah. You were talking about the first real animal we actually get to see, which is a cat.
It's a cat. That they pick up thinking it is a fake cat and they can't figure out what is wrong with it.
Well, the owner calls them because the owner thinks they're a real vet place, and they come and they're like, oh, this must be an electric cat. And they're like, oh shit, this is actually a real cat.
And then the cat fucking dies.
Yeah. And then the wife, knowing that the husband won't be able to bear the cat being dead, the wife does what Rick did for his wife, which is lie and order an electric replacement without telling them that it's not real.
Yeah. This just adds on to the layer of the cynical
literally pretending
of these
pretending to your partner that the animal you have is a real animal, not just to your neighbors, but like to your significant other.
Like all the real animals are just subject to the most accidentally destructive tendencies of humanity. And it's just like, well, I guess we can't keep these things alive. So I guess we're just going to have to make them electric. That owl is electric too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fake. Right.
Yeah, that's one that they start by lying and trying to tell them that it's real.
Yeah, well, that's how Deckard decides to do one final test on Rachel, is she keeps referring to the owl as an it, as mm-hmm. opposed to a she.
Mm-hmm.
Which we're not gonna get into the idea that the pronoun thing about that, like a living thing can't be an it, because that's not in any sense. I just wanted to lay it out there. That's not in any sense the way that Philip K. Dick is thinking about this. This is specifically in the fact that Deckard is noticing that Rachel refers to the owl as an object, not as a living creature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he catches her in the fact that she actually is an android and not a person.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to make sure that any of our sort of, non-binary or different pronoun using friends didn't feel like we were being dismissive of people that use it or its pronouns. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about this within the context of the story. Anyway.
Yeah. Yes. So just kind of showing the really honestly just sad fact that people even need these electric animals in the first place.
Yeah, it's, again, that's one of the other undercurrents of the story between the androids and the android animals, is this like need for, an ersatz replacement, right? A need for a simulacra of animal life as like the sort of need that we have socially to do our social reproduction. Like, you need to have this animal because you're supposed to have an animal, but most people can't have animals. So you have a fake animal, but you tell everyone it's real. Like,
yeah, you gotta fake animal, tell everyone it's real, and half the time people fucking resent those electric animals because they're not the real animal that they want.
Yeah, you're taking care of it because you have to keep up in the eyes of your neighbors, but you resent that you have to because you know it's not real. But even you can't even really trick yourself into thinking that it's real, because you know it's not. And also, you can't push a button that makes you want to push the buttons if you don't want to push the button.
It's like it's all connected.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it is. Like, I'm going to get this fake animal that I have to feel like I have to take care of, but I don't want to take care of it because it's not real, but I have to because I can't get a real one.
Yeah, it's circular logic again.
Man.
All for mercerism, which we find out by the end.
Not real.
Not real. Very much a made up religion.
What? Well,
in the sense that not about. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I think that's it's a little side avenue we can explore here, if you're willing, is that, so we learn Buster Friendly's big fucking expose is that Mercer wasn't a real person within
Buster Friendly's expose is like foreshadowed for the entire thing.
He keeps like telling you about
he keeps saying, "Oh, tune in this day, my big stories are coming." And then,
yeah, his big story is that they discovered that Wilbur Mercer was never a real person. It was a character played by an actor for a series of shorts, and this actor was someone they went and like interviewed named Al Jerry. But in the ensuing time, between when he played these shorts and the current present day in the novel, Mercerism has become a major religion.
Mm-hmm.
That, so far as I can tell, the tenets are take care of animals and use your empathy box, which will force or allow you to physically relive the passion of the Christ.
Yeah.
You inhabit the body of Mercer as he walks up a hill getting rocks thrown at him. And then eventually in the story, Mercer reaches the top and is killed by rocks.
Uh-huh.
Through the empathy box, people have died using the empathy box because they are too empathetic for this character of Mercer, and they actually get their arms hurt or can die. So we discussed it off mic before we started recording, is imagine if like Christians invented a way for you to like stick your head in a box and be able to live through the carrying of the cross and the crucifixion. And that's how you're supposed to feel empathy for and connect with your God.
Yeah, like, not just them, apparently with everyone else who's currently using their empathy box. Yeah,
everyone using the empathy box at the time are all there together, all currently feeling what it was like to wear a crown of thorns all at the same time.
It's a weird replacement for social interaction.
Yeah, I think, and that's where Mercerism, like why it grew, is that in this empty world, it does two things. It encourages empathy with animals and connection with other people, which are two things that are hard to come by in the world at this point. And so it makes sense why this religion sort of took off. But then, of course, Buster Friendly's whole revelation is that Mercer wasn't a real person at all. He never raised animals from the dead. He never did anything like that. But well, that does bring us... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
It's also, I think, important to note that Buster Friendly is an android.
Yes.
So...
Wait, I don't remember. Does Buster Friendly know he's an android?
Oh, shit. Does he know, or does what's his name just tell you that he's one of their own?
Does Rutger Hauer tell me that? I don't
remember. Yeah, I was about to say. by the way, the one girl's name is Pris. I just keep forgetting.
Yeah. You know who the fuck I mean. Rutger fucking Hauer.
Roy. Roy.
Yeah, Roy. Roy. Batty.
Roy Batty. Luba Luft. These names are the names of the androids are super cool, by the way. Really appreciate those. Luba Luft. That's such a what the fuck. Oh, also, the USSR still exists in this book. MLs would love to know.
Yeah, the MLs will be happy the fact that the Soviets are still around.
Unfortunately, still so is America. So accurate, probably, to yeah. What would have happened had they both still existed post World War III or whatever they call it, World War Zenith,
World War Terminus.
Terminus.
Buster Friendly is an android. that people don't know that. But I think that's what I think he must know, because I think that's what fuels his research into the fact that mercerism is a lie, is the fact that he's an android and he wants to prove that this human shit is fake.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that's why he does the whole expose.
Yes.
Is because he knows he's an android.
So by the way, so that means right by the end of this, two of the three methods of avoiding emptiness are gone.
Mercerism and
Buster Friendly.
And Buster Friendly.
Like, they've both been demystified to an extreme, to so much of an extreme extent that, like, the empathy box, it's like, for most people, what would the point be anymore? Obviously, we get one more empathy box use before the end of the story following the big moment, which is the first time we see Rick use an empathy box. And he does the whole walk to the top.
Yeah, he does the passion.
And
I don't know if that's a proper name for like the walk that Jesus had to do with the cross from like, you know, the place to the hill. I don't know if that's the name. I'm just calling it that because I don't know the real name.
Well, let me make sure. But
I'm sure the Catholics have a name for it.
The incidency passion of Jesus. Yeah, it's the short final period in the life of Jesus Christ. So
it is just called the passion.
It would just be the passion would be probably everything from when he gets arrested up until he is resurrected.
I'm saying Catholic specifically because if you were like me and grew up like, you know, one of the really vanilla Methodist Christians, you probably don't have a word for it because like, why would you?
I don't know. I'm sure evangelicals go a little crazy for it.
Yeah.
Evangelicals who created the Passion of the Christ film. So
yeah, we'll go ask old Melly G what it's called. But anyway, yeah, Rick finally uses one at the end and basically does the entire journey, like the whole 9 yards.
Afterwards, ends up with what he thought was a living frog.
It not though.
It was not.
His wife discovers it is not.
Which, to be fair, makes sense. I'm pretty sure that most amphibians, and given Fallout's ability to infest everything, would probably all die off.
Yeah, I don't think there would still be an alive thing that lived in the water.
Yeah, seeing as they can't really take in things through their skin.
Well, it's a toad, not a frog. A toad doesn't have to be in the water.
Well, yeah, but toads still can absorb shit through their skin.
Yeah, also, it seems to be that anything that's on the ground was more susceptible, which is why all their animals live on the roof of their buildings. So there's a point I wanted to make then, a sort of general point about mercerism, though, and this is a more of an existential question, is that if all those people believe in it, all 11 people that are still left on Earth,
yeah,
however many.
Every character in this book is everyone that's left.
Yeah, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter precisely how many. Just there's a community out there that clearly believe in mercerism. Even after Buster Friendly proves that it's not real, can mercerism still serve its purpose of promoting empathy and human connection, even once you know how it was found, that it was founded on a lie?
This is it's
can all... it still do? Can a simulacrum of religion still provide you what religion is supposed to provide you?
Oh my God! Am I starting to come to the conclusion that everything? Oh my God! You have simulacra of emotion. You have simulacra of animals. You have simulacra of people as beings. Sans emotion, you have simulacra of religion, you have like all of these things. Everything in this book is a simulacra of something.
Every major thing you come in contact with is proven to be a simulacra of what you thought.
Even the empathy box is kind of a weird simulacra of empathy itself.
Yeah, because it's not real empathy. You're like it's making you feel like you're experiencing empathy with someone who wasn't real.
it's all 17 layers. Where does this go? It's simulacra all the way down.
Wasn't there some sort of philosophical work with simulacra in the title? I feel like I see all the real theory heads post about on Twitter that I just ignore.
The people on philosophy Twitter, the ones who actually read.
Yeah.
I Yeah, that's the difference between left and philosophy Twitter. Philosophy Twitter actually reads. Left Twitter does not.
Well, depends. There's like there's overlap between the two.
But
Simulacra and Simulation. Baudrillard.
I've heard that name.
In which the author examines the relations between reality, symbols, and society, in particular the significations and symbolism of culture and media involved in constructing an understanding of a shared experience.
Damn.
This was published in 1981.
I was about to say I know what I should have read in preparation, but I'm
reading. I'm reading directly from the Wikipedia here. Simulacra and Simulation is most known for its discussion of symbols, signs, and how they relate to contemporaneity or simultaneous experiences. Huh. Baudrillard claims that our current society has replaced all reality and meaning with symbols and signs, and that human experience is a simulation of reality. Sounds familiar.
Jinkies.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say Baudrillard is a hack and stole all of this from Philip K. Dick.
I'm sure that he's not even the first person to have said anything similar. No.
Of course, I want it to be clear that Jean Baudrillard is, of course, French, who is the only kind of philosopher that would have come up with this sort of thing.
In fucking like a French. Well, now I'm curious. Now I want to read it. I'm sure that there's some problematic thing about him that I should know. I'll ask someone on Twitter.
You should know that Baudrillard is into postmodern philosophy. So.
Oh, that's so scary, man. I'm not trying to hide like the two or three Foucault books I have on my bookshelf.
Look, I haven't read a single philosopher.
I don't have.
Well, just kidding. Just kidding. I technically read some of the ancient ones because I did from a class I had to take.
I bought a copy of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations because it was like $2.
Marcus Aurelius, even though I know my dick,
I know he was super problematic, but it's like regardless, I bought it partially because I had a Mutants and Masterminds character who'd been around since Rome. And was raised as a servant in the house of Aurelius.
Oh,
so gosh. I was like, I came up with that like in retro. So I was like, oh, I'll just read the Meditations real quick, so I know what the fuck like this character would have thought when he was a kid.
I mean, my biggest problem, honestly, with Marcus Aurelius is that he was a Stoic, and
yeah, that's the thing.
That's not the Greek school of thought that I draw inspiration from. If you can't tell. Mine is definitely cynicism.
Ye old Diogenes.
The only Greek I respect, Diogenes.
The greatest Twitter poster who ever did live.
The greatest poster of all time, Diogenes of Sinope. Or as the great poster would say, I don't give a shit. Eat my shit and hair. I don't care.
Eat my shit and hair.
No, so... as we were saying that over and over again, I was like, I feel like there was a whole philosopher who wrote a whole thing about this. Now, somebody out there is going to tell me I'm misunderstanding what Baudrillard is about. And you know what? You're probably right. It just seems like a weird
coincidence. We essentially read the Wikipedia version of the abstract. Probably getting something wrong, but
yeah. But what I was going for and why I felt the need to look it up, because I felt like it was sort of on the same wavelength, is the fact that this book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, is essentially, it seems to be kind of what Baudrillard is talking about there, where reality has become entirely simulations. Because if you look at the end of the book, if you're looking at Rick Deckard's life, aside from his wife, everything is a simulacrum. His animal's not real. His religion's not real. And I mean, he even sort of temporarily does a little wife replacement with Rachel.
Who's not real.
Well, again, we're not going to get back into the argument about whether robots are real or not.
But people think that might be the main point of the book. That's not the main point.
It's really not. The android is clearly a simulacrum of a person, right? Yeah. So like by the end of the book, pretty much down to the point that nothing in Deckard's life is real except his wife. That's it.
Yeah, the more I think about it, it's a very I Love Big Brother ending. You know, it's very.
He gets to the end and he's like, everything's fake.
Fine. I accept that. And then goes to sleep.
Yeah, I think he, at the end, it's where they do a little flip reverse, because at the end, Deckard is where his wife was at the start, where he just goes, fuck it. Who gives a shit? It is what it is. You know, give it up. It's Chinatown. And he fucking goes and goes to bed. And his wife is the one that goes, nah, it's going to be somewhat important to him. We're going to take care of this fucking toad. Like, we're going to take care of this fake animal.
Iran is a good person.
The only two good people in this story are Iran and Isidore.
I feel like Iran legitimately cares about Rick.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think she necessarily, like, is, you know, happy with him all the time.
No.
And I think she occasionally resents him. Which, you know, does happen in long-term relationships and should happen if your spouse is a fucking rent-a-cop.
But, yes.
But I do think she genuinely cares about him. The same way I do think Isidore generally cares about living things. You know, I mean, generally, like he doesn't have a specific relationship to focus on. But I think they are the, if you could point him out, are the only two unambiguously good people in the story. Iran largely through the fact that you don't see her as much,
and she Isidore is through almost pure childlike innocence
and whimsy,
yeah,
and which of course has to be destroyed by the androids murdering a spider.
It's destroyed by the androids murdering a spider generally. And just generally being in the
being androids. Yeah, being androids. And Iran is because, well, we only see her a couple times, so we don't really get to know much more about her than the fact that she seems to be a genuinely decent person who is troubled by the never-ending misery that is the world they all live in, which, mm-hmm. who wouldn't be?
She seems to be stay-at-home, too, which probably gives her more time to think about it.
Ponder the emptiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think she definitely does stay at home because, like, that's when she would have time to sit there with the TV off and notice, you know, the pounding silence.
In a world that empty, what the fuck do you do for 8 hours a day?
You watch Buster Friendly.
You watch Buster Friendly for fucking 8 hours. It's the only TV show.
That's, you know, Buster Friendly being an android is also the only explanation for why he can broadcast 23 hours a day.
Yeah. So yeah, that is something that they kind of point out, right? Is that they're like, yeah, this should have been obvious to everyone. But yeah, no one wanted to believe that he was an android.
He's always on.
He's on the radio, he's on the TV all the time.
Which also makes me wonder, because unless there's another Buster Friendly, like they just roll him off an assembly line, the show wouldn't last that long. Or is their short lifespan only a movie thing that I'm misremembering? I think
the short lifespan is only a movie thing.
That I'm misremembering? You're right. I don't remember them actually mentioning anything about an artificially shortened lifespan in the book. I think that's just a Ridley Scott thing. Which of it is, fuck you for fucking with my memory, Ridley Scott.
But, fundamentally, the more we sit here and talk about this, the more ridiculous it is, I think, that the message someone could pull from this was the question as to whether or not androids are people, because that the more we talk about it, the more I realize that has nothing to do with this book at all.
Like it's there, but simply as a storytelling device for the reader to look into all these other questions. It's the same way Deckard and Iran having a fight at the start is there. But the story is not about that argument they have in the morning. That argument is a device for you to learn what his job is and what the brain juice box is. And who, right? It's there as a vehicle to get you somewhere else. This idea of like androids being people is kind of just a vehicle to get you on to other questions.
Because fundamentally, the answer to the question, are androids people in this book, is it's like, no. That doesn't matter. They never should have been fucking made to begin with.
Yeah, well, I mean, the book would tell you off the bat, number one, no, they're not people, clearly. That's like an easy go-to, I think.
It's
the book doesn't even really hem and haw about that.
It it's way more like the tweet that I shared when I thought of this book than I thought it was. Where the tweet that I shared literally was just like, book is about thing and says not to make thing, warning about how not to make thing, company then goes out and makes thing. And this book's main thing is don't fucking make simulacra of real shit. Yeah. Do not make androids. Bad idea. Just don't make them. Just don't even do it.
Yeah, like it. There should never come to the point where are they a person is even a question.
It's even a question because like the thing that ended up, like the thing that made them into these things had no empathy about whether or not they should. It gave them the ability to understand. It made psychopaths for nothing.
Also, I think the point there is that the Rosen Company itself and the people within it have to inherently have no empathy in order to create these androids in the first place. So the question of whether the androids feel things is superseded by the fact that humans had to lack that to start with.
Yeah, it's like
if the humans had empathy, they wouldn't have made these robots in the first place.
This would be unnecessary. You don't need to do that.
Which the more we talk about it, again, this book more and more drills home my long-term stance that we shouldn't do any of this.
This technology is just getting out of hand.
Every time that they're like, we've made a computer that can think better, my immediate response is, you should break it right now.
I will say,
we made a computer that can learn specific things. Yeah, well, fuck those things and fuck that computer.
I feel like I have rationalized the fact that I will always be smarter than a computer by the fact that at work we have a little bill acceptor that we deposit our bills in at the end of the night. And the dumb fucking machine can't tell a goddamn wrinkled 20 from a clean one. And I'm like, well, at least I know that I am smarter than a computer. Because it doesn't matter if you hand that $20 bill to me in a crumpled up mess, or if you hand that $20 bill to me perfectly clean off the assembly line, I know that it's a fucking $20 bill, and you don't have to feed me 8 trillion generated images using a bunch of AI that program deep learning bullshit.
I, however, am not confident that there will never be a computer smarter than me.
Listen, we'll probably all kill ourselves before that happens, honestly.
I mean, it's possible. I'm just saying, I'm not confident that I'm smart enough to never be outclassed by a computer.
Again, it depends on what you define intelligence as. So.
My standpoint, as always, is that we shouldn't let computers get there. Or even close to them at all. Yeah. I think computers are already too smart. I think we need to go back. The computers we have are already too smart.
These computers we have are too smart and then too disposable at the same time. You end up in a situation where this stuff is mass produced.
You know what you have if you have a bunch of mass produced, highly intelligent, but disposable things? Androids. Psychopath androids. You know what the androids are? Mass-produced intelligent technology that is inherently supposed to be disposable. And you know how that worked out? Bad. For all of Deckard Cain's pets. Okay?
Deckard.
God damn it.
You did it again.
Rick Deckard. God damn it. Oh, the other video game nerds are going to be all over my shit for knowing what
you're doing. Okay, now I'm going to...
It's a main NPC from all the Diablo games.
Ah,
it's the old man that does all the lore for you.
Ah, yes.
Stay a while and listen. I'm Deckard Cain. I'm the last of the protectors of the ancient Haradrim knowledge. I know everything about the war between the angels and the demons.
And now he's owned by Microsoft.
Yeah. like everything else.
Everything else.
So all of my Diablo nerds out there, I'm sorry. I keep wanting to, by just saying Deckard, I want to say Deckard Cain as opposed to Rick Deckard. I should have just called him Harrison Ford the whole time. That would have cleared this up.
That would have cleared things up. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So Harrison Ford, but don't make simulacra of things.
Yeah. That's the entire lesson of this goddamn book. And yet someone's like, hey, let's do Neuralink. Like, fuck you. Let's do Neuralink to try and fake human experience.
No, I'm going to go a step further. You ready? Are you ready?
Oh, boy.
That means we need to abolish social media.
Oh, God, man. What would I ever do?
Twitter is a simulacrum. Actually, that's a lie. Twitter's not actually a simulacrum of having friends, because by and large, there are people at the other end interacting with you, but not always. Twitter botnets are famous for Twitter. We know that Twitter has botnets and there are bots on Twitter.
It's kind of a simulacrum of social.
It's a simulacrum of community.
Yeah.
There are the social interaction isn't invented because like,
It isn't invented, but it is partially curated, and it is incentivized. Like, different forms of it are incentivized than what they would be if you were in person.
If Meta ever happens the way they imagine it being, you're doing simulacra.
Well, this is the freaky thing about this book. This book was written in 1968. And all we have done since then is get closer to this.
All we've done is make it more real every step of the way.
So whenever anybody's like, you know, yeah, I think we're kind of heading towards like a cyberpunk. Yes. Yes. We're already there.
We're already in a cyber.
We're already in a cyberpunk.
I don't think we pointed out this book is set in 2021.
Oh, yeah. Fuck. I forgot the first time I fucking read this book, which was the beginning of last year.
Yeah, this book is set in 2021.
It was set in the same year. And it doesn't, aside from the lack of, you know, nuclear bomb dropping on everybody, the feeling of emptiness is a thing still. That's something that people have talked about for 10, 20 years now, is the feeling of like isolation in a surprising, like, we're more connected than ever, but more alone. And it's just like, why has this book been used like a manual? Like, it's not. This is a cautionary thing. This is like a fuck, don't do this shit book. And I think that's a running theme.
I sort of said it as a joke, but I think a lot of social media is leaning towards that direction.
Not just social media, but technology writ large.
Yeah, where everything we do is mediated through some sort of technological screen, right? Like,
the pandemic certainly didn't help.
Yeah, imagine in the book you have the empathy box where you feel Mercer's journey, and you can also sort of feel all the other people taking the journey at the same time. That's social media is really not that different. Mm-mm. Like, we're all just feeling each other's emotional troubles at the same time, mediated through a form of technology. I mean, this is, I feel bad because I don't want to be like straying into like, I am 14 and this is deep. Like,
social
media is bad, but remember, like,
we're discussing Philip K. Dick. He's blunt as hell. There are plenty of I am 14 and this is deep, like, conclusions to make, because he makes them very plain.
He does make them constantly. Like, even when they're not the main point of his book, he still throws them in there. Like, hey, isn't this fucking stupid? And you're like, yeah, okay, yes.
He's like, now I will say this other thing that is plainly awful. And you're like, yeah, yes, okay.
But I mean, I do feel like we kind of hit on something there. And that, like, the end of this book just shows you that everything he interacts with, that Deckard interacts with by the end of the story, is all fake.
With just the exception of his wife.
And his wife is helping maintain it for him by, like, lying about the toad.
It is just the I love Big Brother ending, where the ending is, you know, super fucking bleak and sad, but there's that tiny, tiny little bit in, like, the appendices that's like, oh yeah, this thing is gonna fall apart in like 10 years, where at the very least he has Euron.
Yeah, it's like, well, he has his wife, and she,
which he doesn't deserve, but whatever.
She seems to kind of like him, which, I don't know. We're now going on some tropes where, like, the man is shit and he just needs his wife to support him because he can't manage.
Well,
it
no,
himself.
I think
again, they are sort of doing it for each other, because he is doing it for her at the start. Like, even though it seems weird and he's like sort of bullying her into using the brain juice machine, he's only doing it because he thinks that's what's best for her. And he clearly does care about his wife.
I think part of the real thing here is that the only thing that is real is a legitimate human connection with someone else that shares that human connection back with him, mm-hmm. regardless of how tenuous that connection might be, or how sometimes it gets strained, or how flippantly he, you know, kind of messes with it at points. It doesn't.
Yeah, about going to fuck a robot.
Yes. That was still a simulacrum of relationship.
That was, it's interesting because that was the chance, or like the opportunity, the temptation for him to give up all real relationships,
mm-hmm.
because the one with his wife was the last one.
Yes.
And this was his taste of giving up all of them. And we see how well that worked out for him.
Yes. Yeah, fucking killed the only other living thing that could have been there for him, which would have been that goat.
Which I'm going to be honest with you, from my personal experience, if the only animal you have for companionship nearby is a goat, good luck. Goats are devious little bastards at times.
Oh, I'm sure. So I had a
I would much prefer something.
Goats, but
I would much prefer a cow. Or
Oh yeah. In terms of just something you'd like, just fucking lay around with and hang out with, a cow. Yeah.
Way friendlier. Goats can.
Cows are so fucking cute. I'm sorry.
Goats' pupils are weird. I don't like their eyes.
Goats are not the only ones with those pupils, but
yeah, sheep also have them, and sheep are also weird for different reasons. Anyway,
actually, horses have the eyes as well. They're just usually the irises of their eyes are usually so dark.
Yeah, that you can't tell. You can see. Yeah, hide that shit from me. It's weird. I don't like it.
Yeah, most.
I mean,
bovine creatures have it.
I'm also just not that big a fan of horses, personally.
Sorry, not bovine. What's the word for creature with hooves?
Hooved.
I know the actual name. Hold on.
I don't.
Hooved animals. I will look that up real quick. There's a word for them. Ungulates.
Yeah, sure.
UNGULATES.
I'm just saying, I'm also not a huge fan of horses.
They're
really strong and really easily frightened.
Mm-hmm. That's not a great combo.
Not a great combo. No, of things.
Again, give me a cow.
Yeah, cow's way better.
Yeah, give me a cow. I'll play trumpet. I don't know how to play trumpet, but I'll play trumpet near them, and they'll just sit there and watch
me. Give me a pig.
Yes.
Pigs are
unironically, yes. I kind of want a micro pig.
Pigs are dope as hell.
Instead of a dog. Like,
I mean, my dog's super cool too.
But I would be like, it's not on the banned pets list at my apartment complex.
Hell yeah.
Just kidding. I'm sure my neighbors would object because pigs are loud.
Everyone sign up for the Patreon so Catho can get a pig.
Yes, because the pet fee here is fucking ridiculous. So yes, please do that.
I'm gonna add a new Patreon goal. Let's get Catho a pig.
Get Catho a pig. That would make Melissa really happy. But
come towards the end here, I think we really have come around to the fact that the lesson of this book is that a genuine reciprocal human connection is the single most like important thing that you could hold on to in a world that's trying to fake everything for you.
That's so deep.
So good luck with that.
That's deep. Yeah. Yeah. Good luck. Especially when every aspect of reality is trying desperately to get you to jump into the Matrix. So
they're going to have to commit violent offenses against me to get me to join the metaverse.
And you know, the more you think about it, there's a reason that this is considered fundamental for cyberpunk. And when I think of some of the other big cyberpunk properties, I think of things like Ghost in the Shell. I think of things like The Matrix, and all of them deal with, especially those two specifically deal with simulation of reality. Mm-hmm. It's
that's literally the Matrix's whole thing.
That's the Matrix's whole thing, literally, with the Matrix. But like Ghost in the Shell has that shit as well.
I'm pretty sure that the Wachowskis in one of their interviews like mentioned that they read Baudrillard.
Oh, that, like, oh yeah,
I'm pretty sure that they said that that's where they got out of this.
They also, if I remember correctly, talk really highly of the original Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, because it's good.
I mean, it is. So, yeah, it's one of my favorite movies. But like,
sign up for the Patreon. We'll talk about it on a bonus episode.
We'll talk about Ghost. We'll talk about Ghost in the Shell.
I'm sorry, I've said it too many times. It just, the jokes are too easy.
Yeah, I mean,
but no, you're right. It's a fundamental concept of cyberpunk that has then continued through to the other sort of seminal works, the other seminal stuff that we talk about, like sort of within this genre. And I up until literally tonight when we were having this discussion, I had never really thought about it that way. Like, obviously you think about The Matrix, you think about simulation theory and this other, other shit.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Obviously
you can't not, but like I hadn't really put it together and thought about it in this sort of totality of that every aspect of your life is trying to do this to you.
Woo.
We did it, fam. Good job.
Here's the thing. That's half the reason that I wanted to even do this podcast. Because, you know, there's things you don't realize until you sit down and talk about it with somebody. And
yeah, I want the audience, all of you dear listeners, to understand that I don't really plan out any of my talking points before we turn the recording on.
I mean, we plan out sometimes.
Well, occasional, like, here are a couple specific things I want to reference. But, like, this isn't some sort of, like, we've sort of planned out our logic and our conclusions before we get here.
Yeah, this really is more like just an off-the-cuff conversation recorded.
Yeah, Kath O'Kan attests to the fact that, like, we'll be doing a thing, and halfway through the recording, I'm like, oh, shit, that's actually a good thing. I never thought of that.
You can tell that this is one of the ones that in quotation marks, since I picked the book, I had to lead, and that's why it's so scatterbrained. But, you know.
Well, because, I mean, anyone, if you've been here for a few episodes, you kind of understand that Ketho's sort of more of the sci-fi guy, and I'm more of the, like, animals beating themselves with swords kind of guy. Because when I was younger, I didn't want to read books that made me think that hard about how depressing the future was going to be.
Yeah. Like even the sci-fi I was a like fan of early on was never Philip K. Dick levels of think about this. You know, I halfway considered like asking us to do both this and like Neuromancer in like pretty close to one another. Just as like a cyberpunk primer.
How dare you make me think that hard?
But I'm like, oh boy, I like Neuromancer.
That's opening.
That's just gonna be a lot to read.
Yeah. Well, it's been sad.
Yeah.
Everything sucks.
I love Big Brother. I'm gonna go to bed.
I mean, that is what I'm gonna do after this recording's over. I'm gonna go to bed.
Me as well.
Because I'm an old man and I get tired. And this is later than we normally record.
I was about to say, this isn't particularly early for you to be going to bed.
No. I mean, as of this moment, it is currently 11 p.m. my time, which is past my bedtime. That's what happens when you have a job that starts at 5 a.m.
Okay, yeah, we need to get the hell moving.
Hey, we're working on it. So everyone, I hope this was an enlightening discussion. I hope you sort of came at this work from a new angle. Again, our takeaways, whether the androids have our people or not, it kind of doesn't matter at all. And that's the most shallow sort of question you can be asking about this work.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, that's what they made the movie about, though.
Yeah, well, it's also the first question you get to. Mm-hmm. I would say, though, if I really had to think about it, that's probably also the one that would translate the best to just being a blockbuster movie
or a blockbuster video game like Fallout 4 or something.
Yeah, like I don't think a lot of the other things we talked about would actually translate that well into like a movie adaption. But what we're here to do, and I think we successfully did today, is look beyond that. Like, what is it else that's going on? It's emptiness. It's the emptiness in the world of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? The emptiness is tangible almost, and it's the result of nuclear fallout and people emigrating, but it is a stand-in for the emptiness we feel in modern life now, right? And we talked about empathy. We talked about the lack thereof in humans is what's led to all these other things that we've already been discussing. And you know what? Maybe do your best. I know it's been really hard because of the, you know, generational pandemic that's been going on, but maybe try to do your best to keep some human connections in your life, or with a pet. If you have one, they're pretty good.
Yeah,
I can tell you that having a dog was a real good boon to my mental health when I got her 4 years ago. It sure did wonders for me. So I can recommend it.
Yeah, if they're my pet fee wasn't ridiculous, I would definitely, yeah.
Even the cat I don't like, it's still nice to have him in the apartment sometimes. He's really cute when he's asleep, which is something. More than I can say about myself. But thank you anyway for joining us here today. Tonight for us, hope this has been enlightening for you. As always,
thank you for joining us tonight.
Yeah, tonight I'm going to use my sexy NPR voice. Thank you for joining us tonight on this chat about
Ketho and Darius after dark.
Thank you for joining us on this chat about the fact that the human condition is one of suffering and loneliness. Sign up to the Patreon. Follow us on social media.
Let's say get your simulacrum on
and talk to me on Twitter. We can have a social interaction mediated by technology,
or just consume this and have a parasocial relationship with us.
Yeah, like I said, or podcast small enough, if you tweet at me enough, we might make it actually social. Who knows? You know, thank you all for listening. As always, our social media links are going to be down in the description if you want to follow us or send us an email. Coming up next, it might not release exactly on time. Might be a week late because it's going to be a lot of reading for me.
And for the first time, not featuring yours truly.
Yeah, Kethel's going to take a little break because his real life has a lot of things going on, apparently, that are more important than hanging out with me. I'll forgive him temporarily. So instead, when we do come back after this one, like I said, there might be a week off in between. I'm going to have a guest, maybe two, on, and we are going to talk about the first three books of The Wheel of Time. So we're going to talk about The Eye of the World, The Great Hunt, and whatever the one after that is. I haven't looked because it's at least 60 hours of audiobook away. So I've got time to get there.
Good luck.
But we are going to be talking about, hopefully, the first three books of The Wheel of Time with at least one, possibly two, special guests. That should take up a bit of the next few weeks. Might have one other one in there before Ketho comes back. And when he does come back, we're planning a special episode with a guest where we talk about the history of genre fiction. Where did it come from? How did it develop into a genre?
Where did it come from? Where did it go?
Is it called Cotton Eye Joe? So it's going to be more of like a sort of a researchy episode where we talk about how we even got to where we are. I think particularly we're going to be talking about the stuff, you know, before Tolkien, more or less. Like, what was he looking at when he was talking about it? Who first was doing fiction? Who invented writing books? Tune back into our podcast to find out. In the meantime, go talk to a real person if it's safe for you to do so. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bro. Are you fucking real, man? Come on.